Hey, good afternoon, and may it please the court. Gregory Lansky, bar registration 38515 for Mr. Daniel Flores.
Hey, your voice is kind of soft. Please, sir, and speak loudly, okay?
Yes, Your Honor. After the jury trial, Mr. Flores was convicted of three counts of first-degree assault, in addition to a count of resisting arrest, and also a non-lesser-included charge of obstruction of a peace officer. This is a direct appeal of those convictions. I also want to point out that he was acquitted of the menacing charge. And on a motion for a judgment acquittal, he also, the kidnapping charge was also dismissed during the trial. What I want to concentrate for this oral arguments is the instructional errors, which was addressed in the briefs. And mainly there's three instructional errors which I want to focus upon. One is the failure of the court to give the affirmative defense of defense of premises when it was requested. And secondly, by inserting the requirement of knowing in the affirmative defense of, I guess, the so-called Make My Day Act or the Home Protection Act. And lastly, the court sua sponte providing the obstruction of peace officer charge without any request upon the parties as non-lesser included. So let me begin by first the first instructional error. Where Mr. Flores' counsel made a request for the affirmative defense of premises. I think we should go back to the procedure, how things were conducted during this trial. And essentially the way they were conducted for the jury instructions, that they were off the record. And when the record was back on, they would note their objections. And that was done for the jury instruction conference and also was done during the reading of the jury instructions. Upon the conclusion of the reading to the jury instructions, counsel realized that their affirmative defense was not the affirmative defense of deadly force, but it was the affirmative defense of physical force. And in fact, they made that correction during the conference. So the instruction that was provided to the jury was really a hybrid of both the Make My Day Act and also Defense of Premises Act.
Does the record indicate that, first, that the Defense of Premises instruction was tendered?
I believe it was. I believe that it was 10. I know it was endorsed as the defense, and I believe it was tendered. I believe, cite to the record. I believe it was tendered, Your Honor. But certainly, it was endorsed as a defense.
Just a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
My second question is whether defense counsel, had an opportunity to review these instructions before they went out in front of the jury.
I think counsel did have the opportunity to review it.
Had he seen the one that was given by the judge?
He seen it, and then he noted there was a mistake in regards to the deadly force part of it. And then he made the correction that it has to be, it's physical force, not deadly force. That was the evidence in this case.
But he made no other correction.
Well, at that point, when the judge then immediately thereafter read those instructions to the jury, he realized, wait, we made a mistake here. This is the wrong instruction. We gave the wrong instruction to the jury. And at that point, the court had an obligation to correctly instruct the jury. And I think what I really want to highlight here, this was all done before arguments in this case.
Let me, if I can ask you about that, Mr. Lansky, and I'm a little unsure about the facts now. I think you're saying, and this is consistent with my understanding from the briefs, that defense counsel here submitted the defense of premises instructions after the court instructed the jury. They realized there was a mistake or something. They submitted a new instruction on defense of premises after. And the court said, too late, you waived it.
But I don't think physically they submitted it after that. I think it may have been submitted.
Or they orally maybe asked for one.
Right.
They asked for a different instruction than what was given. Correct.
Right. I believe so. They asked for the physical force instruction when they realized that there was a deadly force was used.
Okay. And can I ask you, I'm a little bothered by what exactly our standard of review is here. The court, I recognize you disagree, and the court should have given it. But the court here said you waived, or your client waived his right to submit the defense of premises instruction. Given that, do we treat it as if the instruction had not been submitted and reviewed for plain error?
My position, absolutely not. We think it was a timely request. It was done before all our arguments. It was done before the jury began deliberations. It was not, finally submitted in this case. It was a timely request. There was no prejudice on this, on part of the state. The state was aware that this defense was being used. Even if you look at Rule 30, I mean, there's three operative verbs there. The first word is given to the jury. The second operative verb is read to the jury. And the third one is taken by the jury. If this was not a timely request pursuant to Rule 30, then when read to the jury, it would have been read and given. And therefore, you know, at this point, there was still opportunity to provide the correct instruction to the court, so the court can be properly instructed as to the right defense in this case. There are significant rights here, and I think it was timely done. It was timely done before oral arguments. The court certainly had the opportunity to make these corrections. The court indicated that it could change instruction number 20. And I also want to highlight the fact this was one of the last instructions that was done pursuant to the old instructions that were read at the time. So based upon the prior procedure, I mean, counsel's understanding, I'm not going to interrupt the judge when he's reading instructions. I'm going to note my objection, you know, at that point. And he made a record to that fact, you know, prior to the reading of instructions, that he will note, you know, if there's any issues with the instructions. So at this point, I believe it was a timely request that was made to the court. The court had the opportunity to make the right correction to properly instruct the jury. Mostly after they did the oral arguments, the court actually did correct some other instructions in this case. The court noted that it can change instruction number 20. And that the counsel is offering, well, we could put in any definition you want. If the definition of trespass is what you want, we could put that in 20. Or just like the James case, when they realized they made a mistake, they could either do 20 or 28. I mean, this was not a problem. When you look at...
But the James case was the elements of the, if I'm remembering the right case, the elements of the offense were wrong. I mean, here, this is just another defense where the facts were in dispute.
Well, no, I think it's the elements. You talk about two completely different affirmative defenses. And there's a major difference between the Home Protection Act and the defense of premises. There's a lot of hurdles. You don't have to jump, you know, on the defense of premises. You don't have to show that there was a crime was committed or was going to be committed. You don't have to show there's going to be any physical force to be used. I also want to highlight, it's clear in the defense of premise instruction statute that the subjectiveness of, you know, whether someone's unlawfully entering is on the occupant, not on the intruder. And for the mistake how the Home Protection Act was instructed in this case, the subjective, you know, intent was based upon the intruder. So clearly it was a major, major difference, a profound difference between the instructions that were provided. And I submit that it was wrongly done. It can't be deemed a harmless error. An affirmative defense is considered an element that the people have to prove or disprove. They did not do that, you know, in this case, and it can't be harmless. It would lower their burden of proof in this case. And because of the consequential differences between the two affirmative defenses, you know, it can't be harmless, especially based upon the facts, you know, as they came out, you know, during the trial, based upon the evidence.
Is there some evidence in the record, Mr. Lansky, that this defense of premises instruction that we're talking about was submitted before the jury was instructed?
No. Let me just take one thing. I believe it was. I believe I may have cited it too in my reply brief. I know it definitely was endorsed, and I believe it also was. Let me just quickly check. But I believe when I cite to it in my reply brief, it has a citation to that. So if the court wants
we can
to refer to that. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's 119. I think it is. I'm trying to do it based on my memory.
I'll look for that. Thank you.
Okay. It is. I think it's volume 119. On page 119, which now goes into the second argument now with regards to the court inserting the known requirement as to no one unlawful entry.
And that one doesn't McNeese decide this? I recognize you think McNeese may be wrong, but we're bound by the Supreme Court.
I don't think this court's bound. I don't think McNeese is control on this case. McNeese was doing an issue in regards to immunity, you know, pre-trial immunity, where, you know, the court decides whether or not that whether immunity has been proven by the defendant by preponderance of evidence. There is no precedent in regards to what's the proper instruction for the Home Protection Act when it's raised as an affirmative defense. Now, if you actually look at the subsequent cases, you look at James, and they decided pretty much on different grounds, and you look at the recent case by Judge Flores Sukoski. I mean, she notes that, you know, the instructions, you know, James didn't approve of the issue of that was a proper instruction regards to good faith or a mistake. Judge Boris highlighted, you know, there's a big issue here because even James, Supreme Court, Judge Malarkey and James indicated it's a big difference when you're dealing with an immunity issue and an affirmative defense because of the different burdens of proof. And when you have a known intent, a known unlawful requirement, it's a very confusing way to instruct the jury. A court can understand that, but when you do these concepts, to a jury. We're not going to stand with no one unlawful entry is. I mean, in fact, that's Paul McNeese case. You have the Chief Justice and Judge Scott, you know, doing a scathing dissenting. This is not what the statute, says. There is no requirement. It's the requirement is upon the occupant, not the intruder. And that's in the, it's not in the Trespasser Protection Act. It's named the Home Rule Protection Act. It's absolute immunity.
And they dissented because the majority said what you're saying they didn't say. Quote, for purposes of Section 18.1704.5, the unlawful entry element requires an entry in knowing violation of the criminal law. I understand you don't like it, and maybe the context was immunity. It's a pretty unambiguous statement to me.
Well, that's different than what was instructed in Mr. Flores' case. It was a non-for entry. So that's not what was instructed. The jury pattern jury instruction doesn't say that, you know, for the Home Protection Act. And again, you're in a different, you know, they didn't deal with the issue of affirmative defense. They only dealt with the issue of immunity. And I think there's different considerations that need to be made when you do an affirmative defense because they have to disprove the affirmative defense. And you look at the facts in this case, it was impossible for Mr. Flores to win an affirmative defense based upon these instructions that he had to know the subjective intent, you know, of the people breaking into his apartment. It was impossible.
Mr. Lansky, pardon me for interrupting. I just want to make sure I get a chance to ask you this question. This is on the discovery issue. And the people have cited People versus Pagan that says that you have to have moved for a continuance, or the defendant has to have moved for a continuance in order for the issue to be considered, basically, or to be a problem. Can you please address that, the Pagan case?
Well, yeah, I think the court, Mr. Flores' attorney, has asked specifically, I want sanctions. He said, I want sanctions. If you look at the discovery statute, what sanctions includes, it includes continuance. So they did ask for a continuance. They asked for sanctions. That's one of the options the trial court had at that point.
I'm not certain what it is you're citing for something saying that sanctions includes a continuance.
Again, that's in my reply brief. And let me see if I quickly have it for you. But it's definitely 16.3G.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'll go back to the argument in regards to the knowing requirement. I think there is a significant and consequential difference when it's raised as an affirmative defense. And I don't think this court's hands are tied, you know, in regards to have to follow from McNeese, because they're not. That was an immunity. And I think this court actually could provide guidance to the trial court to show this is how you should properly instruct, you know, for this offense. Because right now, the courts are not doing that. If you look at all the decisions, they're not properly done it. For us, reverse that decision because of the improper instruction in that case. And that's clearly what happened in Mr. Flores' case. And there was essentially a good faith exception. And isn't that what a known unlawful requirement is? It's a good faith exception. And Judge Blair said that's not wrong. You know, that's contrary to the purpose of the Home Protection Act. And it's not really what was stated, for an affirmative defense. And I think this court can provide some guidance, especially in a situation where Mr. Flores was not given us the opportunity to raise an affirmative defense because it was almost impossible. It switched the burden to him to prove that they didn't have a good faith ability to go into his apartment. And that's not how the affirmative defenses work. The state has the burden to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's especially problematic in Mr. Flores' case because that same instruction says based upon a lack of evidence. So that could be construed on a jury that if there was no evidence by Mr. Flores to show that there was no good faith exception, then the people didn't necessarily have to disprove it because there's no evidence there. So I think it's especially problematic in Mr. Flores' case. And with that, I want to reserve the rest of my time, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Odala, registration number 39218, representing the people in this matter. I'll start with the make my day instruction. I'll try to respond to all of the defendant's points that he made in his argument. I think most of the defendant's argument is relying on the dissent in McNeese, and obviously I think this court is obligated to follow the majority opinion in that case, which says that an unlawful entry means a knowing criminal entry. And I think the trial court's instruction on this affirmative defense was correct in line with what McNeese says. And I don't think, first of all, before, I think, you know, the instruction was consistent with McNeese, but the elements of make my day are the same regardless of whether you're looking at, you know, at the immunity stage or the affirmative defense. So I guess I'm not really seeing the defendant's distinction in that regard. The elements are of Make My Day are what they are. It's just a question of, you know, who has the burden and under what standard. But that
doesn't make a difference whether an affirmative defense should be given as opposed to whether a person's entitled to immunity.
Well, certainly it's a different standard. At the immunity stage, the defendant has the burden of proving all of the elements of Make My Day by a preponderance.
Okay, now here we're talking about the giving of an affirmative defense.
I agree. We're talking about an affirmative defense, which the prosecution has to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. I agree with that, but that doesn't change the fact that of what actually has to be proven. And regardless of whether we were talking about the defendant at, you know, pretrial stage or the prosecution at this stage, the proof needs to be that there was a knowing criminal entry in line with what McNeese said. So I think that the court's instruction was correct in line with McNeese. And I mean, frankly, I think the Zukowski decision is, it's questionable whether that decision is following McNeese, but this court needs to follow McNeese. That's the Colorado Supreme Court, and it, in no uncertain terms, says that the unlawful entry is a knowing criminal entry. So I don't think there was any error with respect to that instruction. The court has no further questions on that issue. I'll move on to the defense of premises affirmative defense instruction. I know the court was kind of questioning how this happened factually. I just reread my brief on that point, and I believe the defendant interrupted the court while the court was reading the final jury instructions.
Question is, what happened in the discussion of the jury instructions before you went out in front of the jury?
Right, and I don't believe that any affirmative defense instruction was requested at that point. I think the defense counsel, so something about the court reading the Make My Day instruction to the jury somehow triggered him that he wanted a defense of premises instruction, and the court said something back to him, you know, what are you kidding me? We've been discussing these instructions for 2 days, and now you want another affirmative defense. I'm sorry, you're too late. The court was
really... No, that's not my question. You're telling us what happened at trial during the reading of the jury instructions, and the question I had was, what happened before you went out in front of the jury when you were discussing the jury instructions? Was this instruction the defendant offered discussed?
I don't think so. That's what I'm saying. I think that the defense realized that they wanted the instruction when the court was reading them to the jury after they had already discussed all of the other instructions. During that point, it would have been, you know, obviously the onus on the defendant, if he had wanted this instruction, to point to evidence in the record and request it. I don't believe the defendant requested the instruction during the jury instruction before they got to the point that the court was reading them to the jury. Obviously,
based on that, if I interrupted you, did you finish the sentence? Sorry.
I was going to go on to talk about how I don't think there was credible evidence of the defense anyway, but...
Yeah, let me ask you first, then, assuming that you're right, and certainly we'll look at the piece of the record Mr. Lasky is citing to see, but let's assume for a minute you're right, and that it wasn't submitted before, submitted after closings. Judge said you waived it, it's too late, and that's fairly consistent with my memory of what the testimony was. What's our standard of review here? Same question I asked Mr. Lansky. If the court viewed it as waived, is it a plain error? Do we treat it as if not having been submitted at all and review for plain error or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good question, and you know, I'm not certain of any authority on this point one way or another. I mean, I think the two arguments would be, one, affirmative defense is a matter of defense strategy, so if the defendant isn't requesting it, then it should be waived. You know, it's not something that the court can sua sponte just decide to, you know, give an affirmative defense instruction.
Because it was requested.
What's that?
It was requested during the reading of the jury instructions.
Right, which is, I think, probably getting to the other argument that I made. I believe I cited plain error in my brief because sort of a hybrid of the two here. It was requested, but at a point that I think the trial court believed it was too late. So I think the issue was certain, I guess, before the court. So I guess it would be more appropriate to view it under plain error at that point. I mean, I don't know of any authority either way. I'm just kind of giving you my sense of what the rule should be on that point.
Can you respond to your colleague's argument regarding CRIMP 30, I believe is what he cited, where he was talking about there are three different verbs, you know, when the instruction is given, or whether it's read, or whether it's given, or when it's all over. Can you speak to that?
I'm sorry, I don't, can you, I'm not sure I...
I'm not sure I'm formulating the question very well. I don't think I'm...
On that point, my understanding was that he was not timely under CRIM 330, and that's why I cited it. I guess I think, and I'm not trying to move on from your question, but I think if you're going to be talking about under, you know, plain error, or even if this had been preserved, you're going to be looking whether there's any credible evidence to support the defense under a de novo standard of review, and I don't think the defendant can satisfy that. And he certainly didn't make an argument to that in the trial court, and I think I heard it for the first time in the reply brief, but the defendant had to show that he used reasonable and appropriate force on the officers, which he was reasonably necessary to prevent or terminate an unlawful trespass. And the facts in this case were that the defendant knew the police were at the door. He knew he had just had some type of altercation in the parking lot. I understand the testimony was conflicting on that point, but it's frankly objectively unreasonable to believe that, you know, him attacking the officers with a golf club was going to was reasonably necessary to terminate this encounter.
So, the evidence in the record, perhaps from the companion that was with him in the apartment, that defendant knew that the people who were knocking on the door were police officers?
I believe there's testimony in the record that he was well aware the police were at the door.
And then when they entered, I assume they were all in uniform.
They were all in uniform. I believe the police had been knocking on the door and announcing their presence from behind the door. I don't think the defendant would dispute that point. I can't give you any record sites off the top of my head, but I believe the undisputed evidence was that he was aware that these were the police at the door. I mean, I could see this might be a different situation in terms of any credible evidence to support this defense if, you know, defendant had been awoken in the middle of the night and there was someone pounding on his door and he didn't know who it was, but here he knew it was the police. He knew the police wanted to speak to him about this altercation in the parking lot, and I just don't think, even if you sort of grant the defendant that he subjectively believed that this was necessary, I think it's objectively unreasonable to, you know, the police are knocking at your door and you attack them with the golf club. So on that basis, I don't think there was credible evidence to support giving that instruction.
So, Adela, can I ask you to shift gears, because I don't want you to run out of time here. I'll be very blunt. I have some concern about the discovery issue here on the use of force report. The court concluded, first of all, as I understand it, that it wasn't even requested. And I guess I'm not quite sure how the court could come to the conclusion that it wasn't requested. I mean, you can't, I don't think the court could assume the defendant knows where all these records are kept when the police officer who testified for the city himself didn't know where they were. And so I'd like you to address that. And then assuming this was requested, do we not have to remand to let the court do an in-camera review? You have argued it's not prejudicial because it was just cumulative of everything else. How do we know that? Because we don't have the document. So I would appreciate your addressing that.
You know, I think a lot of this would have come to light had the defendant moved for a continuance and requested the report. I didn't make an argument in my brief as to whether or not this was a discovery violation because I frankly don't have the document. I don't know what the prosecution disclosed pursuant to the subpoena. We have the court's finding that the report didn't fall within the request in the defendant's subpoena.
So yeah, and based on that, why would the defendant have asked to have, why would the defendant have had to ask for a continuance here? The court said you never requested it. There's nothing to be continued. You didn't ask for it. You're out of luck, defendant. Yeah. That was the court's holding.
It was that, but then the court also said that the report should, the court ordered the prosecutor to disclose the, I think they called it in the record, the IEB files of the police IEB files, whatever that is. So I just wasn't sure. I mean, I think to the extent the defendant believed that this was, you know, material and potentially exculpatory, I think if he had moved for a continuance and wanted to put on, you know, have a hearing as to what this
But that's what I'm not understanding. The court earlier required this Internal Enforcement Bureau, I think is maybe what it is. The investigation ordered, defendant asked for a lot of these reports on a lot of officers. The court said, no, you don't get that, but I'll give you on the three arresting officers and plus one other officer, as I remember. Fine. then at trial for the first time the defendant hears about this use of force report and immediately objects. That wasn't provided to us, and says you should sanction. The court says you never requested it, out of luck. How does the defendant request a continuance, or why should he? I mean, this is not a matter of I'm prejudiced. The court said you don't get it because you didn't ask for it. So I don't see what's to be continued.
So you're saying the court should have just dismissed it at that point without...
That was a question. You're saying the defendant should have moved for a continuance, and I'm not understanding why. The court didn't say you're going to get it some other time, or the court said you never asked for it.
So
you're out of luck.
At that point, I agree with that. I guess to the extent that this court was going to find that there was a discovery violation, then I think then you would move on to whether there was any prejudice from that. And that's really why I was making the argument that that there wasn't any prejudice because it was cumulative.
And that's where I was going too. So how would we know that? Normally the process, I think, would be it's an in-camera review, and the court weighs the governmental process privilege versus the officer's rights, and then decides if it should have been disclosed, and then maybe make a determination of prejudice. But because the court said it wasn't even requested, we never got there. So I understand your argument, but I'm not sure how we can assess that because we don't have the document. I appreciate you're a fine lawyer, and I appreciate your good faith, but we don't know that. For all we know, the use of force report could have concluded that this use of force in this case was an outrageous abuse. That would have made a big difference if that's what it said. That I don't know that it does. So why don't we have to remand?
I don't think you have to remand because I think the court did hear some testimony on this issue. It had the sergeant testified that the use of force report contained less information than that was in the police officer's reports.
Nobody ever saw the report other than that particular policeman, I guess. Did the prosecutor have a copy of the report?
The prosecutor said on the record that he did not.
So the judge, the defendant, and the prosecutor had never seen the report.
It seemed to me that the trial court was not concerned about this report and seemed to credit the testimony of the surgeon who said this contained less information that was already in the officer's reports. And I don't think you need to remand because I do believe that the testimony was cumulative to a fairly extensive cross-exam of all of these officers about... about their motive to minimize their conduct with respect to, wanting to, I guess, cover themselves, and they're motivated to minimize what they did in this case.
Ms. Adal, I see that your colleague has cited to CRIMP 16.1.3G, which is failure to comply and sanctions, and his comment is that because that rule includes as a potential sanction a continuance, and because defense counsel requested sanctions, that his position is that that took care of it, and so you didn't need to actually request a sanctions, a continuance by name.
I understand that, and I think that point is pretty flatly contradicted by appellate case law. If you want a continuance, you need to ask for a continuance. You can't expect the trial court to, be clairvoyant and impose a sanction that you're not requesting. I'm just about out of time. Does the court have any further questions? Thank you. I'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
I have a short amount of time, so I just want to touch upon some brief issues. In regards to the evidence sufficient for the defensive premises, I mean, the standard is a scintilla of evidence. And I think clearly that standard was sufficiently provided by the evidence at the trial. In regards to any objective criteria, whether that affirmative defense should be provided, that's for the jury to decide, whether it was reasonable or not. Certainly, I alleged facts, in my reply brief to show that, that defense was, was clearly warranted in this case. And I will highlight again, it was the prosecution that said to defense that it's not deadly force, it's physical force. And physical force is the defensive premises, and it's the deadly force which is used as the Home Protection Act. So clearly, I think there was sufficient evidence for that instruction to be provided to the jury. There's one other issue I want to quickly raise in 20 seconds, is the instruction for the non-lesser included the obstruction by the peace officer. It was not requested as that. Should have not been provided.
You requested an offense of obstruction, but you did, not you, your client did, but just said it was a lesser offense, and it wasn't clear if it was included or non-included, and that seemed to be the debate. Did your client ever object to the giving of the instruction or withdraw it? Your client is the one who tendered it.
Let me just have a matter of time to respond. He objected to the fact the way it was tendered, and because he objected to that fact, it should never have been tendered the way it was tendered.
He tendered it. That's
fine. Not as a lesser included.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will be taken under advisement and written will follow.